This recording of Brave Together, a conversation panel, was moderated by MRO Sangha member Tanya Bonner and features author Pamela Ayo Yetunde, co-editor of Black and Buddhist, and MRO Sangha members Denya Chike Levister and Yama Faye. The four panelists take up questions related to how they encountered Buddhism and connected with the Dharma and their experiences as Black practitioners entering different Sangha communities. This lively discussion is followed by a brief Q&A.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome and thank you, each and every one of you, for being here this evening. As I look around, many of you are familiar, but some of you might be new. My name's Hojin, and I live here at the monastery in Mount Tremper. But we're from all over in this auditorium tonight. So welcome to Brave Together. And it's a good title. And it's a good request. And a good commitment. Brave Together. So please, as practitioners, bring yourself completely forward in your body. Settle yourself into yourself. Be with your breath. And open. Open to being open, to being vulnerable, to practice listening and really listening and letting yourself be affected and heard within yourself. And I want to welcome Tanya Bonner, who will be leading this panel with Pamela Ayo Atunde, Chike, and Yama. And I'll turn it over to Tanya to introduce the panel. And looking forward to being with you all tonight. Thank you all.
Thank you, Hojin. Yes, thank you, everybody, for joining us. This is a first for us, so we're going on this journey together. So thank you for being here on our journey as we have a brave conversation today. I just wanted to start. I'm going to have each panelist introduce themselves, actually. But I just wanted to, you know, just say that this is our second annual of honoring the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And last year, if some of you may have joined us, it was a beautiful ceremony that we had. We did a simultaneous ceremonies at both Fire Lotus Temple in Brooklyn and at the Zen Mountain Monastery. So it was a beautiful thing that we did. And we had people from the community. I was in Brooklyn, and I had people from the community join us. People who had never stepped foot in a Zen temple before. So we were really excited about that. This year, we wanted to dive a little deeper into some things. Particularly, we wanted to spotlight the Black experience this year. And there are many reasons for that. And as, you know, one of which is because, you know, MLK's work is grounded in that. It takes root in the experience of Black people in our country experiencing injustice. And we wanted to take it back to its home, right? To where it all began, this struggle for Black liberation in America. And this is part of that journey that we're doing by having people who identify as Black join us in a discussion about their experiences being Black and being Black and Buddhist. So that's what we're doing today, and it's really exciting to do this. We don't know what to expect. Obviously, we just know that we're going to bring it, as we say. So I appreciate, you know, everybody joining us as we discover for ourselves what is going to unfold tonight. So just thank you for joining us. And we really appreciate your participation in this and helping us to be courageous tonight as we talk about these issues. Thank you. And so with that, I wanted to just open it up to the panel, and each panelist can give us just a brief introduction. Tell them, they're going to tell you a little bit about themselves, and whomever wants to start, feel free.
I'll start.
Thank you, Yala.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. My name is Yama Fai, and I've been a resident at ZCNY for about 6 months. It is a pleasure to be here to see Shoanne. She is just awesome to see you, Can, and Tenfo. So I get a little bit emotional just looking at the faces that I recognize, just being at the temple and the people that, in many ways, when I was going through it, stood by me. And Hogan is one of them. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Yama. Would Chike or Ayo like to go next?
I'll jump in next. I can't promise to be as short as Yaya. you know, first I want to appreciate also the name of this, Brave End Buddhist. For me, so much of this is in that end, you know. I do a lot of panels as part of my professional work. And as I shared with the group earlier, I'm really anxious about this one. And part of it has to do with the topic of tonight, which is being Black and Buddhist in a predominantly white sangha. And what's that like? And I recognize a number of faces here. But I think that probably most of you have no idea even what my story is, despite the fact that I started practicing at the Zen Center of New York City in 1994. My religious traditions before coming to Buddhism, my father was a Black man who grew up in the segregated South in North Carolina, and he came to New York for his education. I'm Black first, biracial second. That's how I identify. My pronouns are on the screen. My father was Southern Baptist. We were Southern Baptist. We went to church every Sunday at the Concord Baptist Church in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. I was baptized by Reverend Gardner Taylor. There's activism sort of in my family history that I just sort of grew up around. And when my parents divorced when we were 8 years old, my mother took my sister and I, I'm an identical twin, to Staten Island, New York, which is the white borough of New York City. I'm not saying anything people don't know. So it was an incredibly hostile place to have left. A community that was supportive and rallied around the election of Shirley Chisholm, and like to go to Staten Island, New York, where people yelled nigger at us walking down the street to go get prosciutto from my mother. My mother was Italian. It was an incredibly difficult place. We were enrolled in Catholic school, no more Baptist. Now we're Catholic. So we were just enrolled in Catholic school. It was a school my mother went to when she was a girl. And there were three Black kids in the entire school. This was a K through high school. And my sister and I were two of the three, right? So you can imagine what that was like. What's with your hair? You know, what's all kinds of stuff. So I just wanted to put that out there. I think that we make all kinds of assumptions about who people are based on what they look like. I wear my hair straighter. I have the, you know, a skin privilege, if you privilege whiteness in our society, but it has allowed me to pursue things in my career and open doors that some of my sisters who happen, and members of my own family who look different from me, have not had the opportunity to pursue. So I really just wanted to put that, you know, out there. I landed at the Zen Center of New York City in 1993, and I met this woman who was sitting up there in Chelsea talking about working on rape crisis hotlines and feminism, and she was wearing this robe, and I was like, that could be a religion, like that you could bring your life and the things that you care about, like, into your, okay, well, I want more of that. And a year later, I scheduled my first ZTW, Zen Training Weekend. As you all know, I came up to the monastery. Awkwardly, they handed me this book, Eight Capes of Zen. I was like, this looks nice. I sat down with my soup. Some guy is sitting next to me. I'm having a conversation, which is lovely, with this man who's asking me, what brings you here? What kind of books have you read? And it was a really lively conversation. I talked about Three Pillars of Zen, and I've always been a philosophy epistemology geek. So what do we, how do we know what we, great conversation. They escort us up to the Zendo for my first time. I walk in, and the guy, the bald-headed guy, he was the head priest. It was Shugen. I'm like, oh, God. I was really honest with somebody about what brought me in the room. Now I'm in trouble. So I say all that because I have been dancing this dance for most of my experience in the MRO. But I met people who were genuine and who were honest. And the Dharma with a capital D has always resonated with me. I met Daito on that first trip as well, and he was my first teacher. And the same sort of openness and generosity, not fully educated, but that is my background.
Thank you, TK. Wonderful story, and thank you for sharing that. Ayo.
Well, I was going to ask you if you wanted to share more about who you are before I share.
Oh, okay. Sure. My name is Tanya. I am been a student. I actually just recently became a student, and I'm a student of Hojin. And I've been attending, I guess you could say, mainly the Brooklyn Center for about 15 years, actually. So I was there for a while before I decided to make that leap and become a student. And I'm originally from Chicago. As Chike related, my spiritual roots were in Christianity, and I didn't know anything about Buddhism at all. I actually was doing yoga, which was another story itself in terms of isolation and feeling sort of like, wow, I'm the only one in here. I was really, really into hot yoga when I was in Boston. Living in Boston for a few years. And one day, it was just a weird experience. It was sort of like, I don't know, maybe it was fate, as we talk about, where someone was mentioning other students, after we were finished with our yoga class, they said, oh, we're going to go over to the Cambridge Zen Center. Do you want to come? And I didn't even know what that was. I'm like, what is that? And so I just, you know, naturally curious, lifetime learner person that I am, I said, sure, I'll go. Why not? And I heard the Dharma talk at the Cambridge Zen Center, and I was blown away. I felt like I had always known this. Like it had always been, it felt like home. You know, when you go somewhere or you go to certain places or you meet certain people and they or those places feel like home, that's what that felt like for me. And I was just curious from then on. I started devouring everything. When they had bookstores, I would go to the bookstore, or go to Barnes & Noble and Borders when they existed. And I would just read. I would go to the Buddhism section, and I just read as much as I could about Zen Buddhism. And I finally, one day came to the Fire Lotus Temple. I have to say I was very nervous. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But my journey has been, people in my family, they didn't understand. They don't understand what this is. Friends don't understand what this is. I was othered in my own community. Like, what are you doing? You know, like, what is that? You know? And I just don't even, sometimes I can't even talk about it because they just don't, they're either will make fun of me or they just don't understand. Remember one day I had a ride share up to the monastery and I was riding up with two white male, people, to go to a retreat. And I was telling someone that I was doing that and I was describing, you know, what it was like. And I remember the person I was telling that to said, "You're going to go into the woods with a bunch of white people and they wear robes. Have you lost your mind?" And I just, they like, "Have you seen the movie Get Out?" Like, and I was, you know, in between laughing hysterically, you know, this is the sort of reactions that you get. And I said, "I'm going to be fine. They're fine. They're fine. One is a long-term student. I know that person." So, but these are some of the things, these are the challenges that we face, even just trying to enter into being curious about this. It's been a journey. It took me a long time to decide to become a student for a number of reasons, some of which we will talk about today. But I am glad that I did take that step because eventually I learned that this is just for me. Like, I can't, you know, this journey is mine. It's not about anything that's happening externally. And I had to just come to just realize that and accept that and accept the robe because I had a problem accepting the robe as well. That's my story. And I'm looking forward to you learning more. As Chike mentioned, I think that I've been here a while. And as she mentioned, I also feel that, you know, this might be the first time people are hearing my story. So thank you, Chike, for bringing that into the space. Ayo.
Good evening, everyone, and happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day to come. I'll just begin with some words of gratitude. I love it when people I don't know reach out to me. That was not always the case. I love that now. And so, Tanya, thank you so much for reaching out to me and inviting me to be a part of your community and meeting your Dharma peeps. It's really important to me. These times, I feel, require us getting to know each other and being with each other in our differences in a way that we learn or relearn to appreciate and embrace and celebrate differences. And so this is an opportunity for us to do that. My name is Pamela Ayo Yetunde. I go by Ayo. I currently live in Chicago, but I've lived quite a few places over the last several years. And I grew up in the United Methodist Church. I went to church every Sunday and kind of had a falling out when I was 16. Didn't go to church in college. I'm going to skip 20 years to say that being brave together, that it was a lack of courage, really, I think, that brought me to Buddhism. It was the lack of bravery. And so for us to be brave together, I really want to get into, I want us to sink our teeth into this topic because it means a lot to me and is what we need right now. What was I afraid of? A couple of things. I was afraid of death and dying. So my father died suddenly. He was 35. My mother was 33. I was 8 and my brother was 5. And that experience traumatized me to death and dying, to the extent of, you know, things like I adopted an attitude that life is too short. You know, whenever I didn't want to do something, life is too short. Do the thing you want to do, right? Life is too short. Why dwell in things you don't want to dwell in? That caught up with me in my 30s. Right. When I realized, I have no commitment to anything or anyone, really. I mean, I have love, but real commitment. Life is too short. Right. But in addition to that, I was in an airport in Tucson, Arizona, when the World Trade Center was being bombed. And we were huddled watching this unfold on a big screen TV in a bar. And I had never experienced in my mind, I can't remember a time where I experienced that much anxiety in a place, in a room. It was mass anxiety. And so I thought, well, you know, once I get back home, I'll be okay. Of course, I'll be concerned, but I'll be okay. But I wasn't okay. I was not okay. I was anxious. I think it was October 7th, before October 7th, George W. Bush declared war and retaliation, but we didn't know who we were retaliating against. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is like, it's on. And I'm a mess. On October 7th, I was turning 40. So I had these plans, like, I'm going to have a big bash. I'm going to throw down. I never thought I'd live to be 40 because my father died when he was 35, right? So 40, yay, but I'm miserable. So had a party, but I asked people not to bring me any gifts because I knew nothing material would soothe what I was experiencing. I said, but bring me peace of mind. If you can bring me peace of mind, you will bring me the greatest gift I've ever had. And one of my friends who is not a Buddhist practitioner, who never heard of this man, saw this book title called Touching Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh. And yeah, short book, handed it to me. She said, I think you might appreciate this. So I knew nothing about Buddhism, nothing about Zen. Touching Peace, yeah, I do want to touch that. Open the book, a few pages in, there's a short guided meditation, you know, breathing in, I am like the mountain, I'm paraphrasing, breathing out, I'm as solid as a mountain, right? And so I do this, I'm like, yes. In an instant, I feel different. In an instant. Also, right around the same time, my application to Zen Hospice Project was accepted. So I was trying to overcome my fear of death and dying. I applied to Zen Hospice because they had a year-long training program. No other hospice had that. So I said, if they accept me, I will go into that program because I need all the training I can get. So the combination of touching peace and being accepted in Zen Hospice Project, as you can imagine, knowing what you know about my background, was so powerful. To be able to feel grounded and connected and confront death and dying all at once. I mean, who is going to shake me from this path, right? No one. So here I am, almost 60, still on the path. I have practiced in the Plum Village tradition, in the Insight tradition. I received what we call community Dharma leader training. And I also sit with the Soto Zen Buddhist community in St. Paul, St. Paul, Minnesota, even though I live in Chicago, because it's such a wonderful community. The communities in the Twin Cities, I feel, have been, for me, the most healthy Dharma communities that I've been a part of because they do their anti-racism work. They do their white awareness work. They also have BIPOC communities. And so people there are doing their work. And I'm glad to be a part of them. And I'm glad to be a part of you this evening. I guess I should also mention, because if I don't, Tanya's probably going to get on me. I don't want Tanya to get on me. We just met. I'm the co-editor of this book, Black and Buddhist, What Buddhism Can Teach Us About Race, Resilience, Transformation, and Freedom. Came out December 8th. It's an anthology of African-American Buddhist leaders across traditions. And I'll say that one thing, a common theme that I've heard about this book from white people is that, wow, the authors are so vulnerable. And I'm like, yeah, we can be vulnerable in writing. And I hope that what we're trying to create are spaces where we all can be vulnerable, as Hojin mentioned in the grounding. To be vulnerable is part and parcel of being brave. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm so grateful and honored to have you here with us. I am. Thank you for saying yes. And one of the things that I noticed in our in everyone's introduction is how we all have a story of how we found that instant connection once we were introduced to Buddhism in some way. Like there was all for each of us, there is that instant recognition and connection to it. And so it just makes me wonder, you know, about why there's so few of us and why it's so difficult for outreach for us or to draw us into these spaces and keep us in these spaces when we obviously in our stories, you know, it indicate that, you know, we do have this connection to the Dharma. We felt that instant connection to it. So it's just a question that I have. It's not anything necessarily we need to explore, but it's just something that came up for me as I was listening to everybody's story of, wow, we all immediately connected once it was brought to us. There was something there that felt home.
But that doesn't mean it's perfect. The deeper you get into it, then like with anything else, the more intimate you become with something, the more you realize what's there and what's not there. Right?
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah. It's something to think about. It's something to think about. Like at what point do we lose that connection with Black people who practice this? Where does that happen? Where is the break? So hopefully we'll be able to discover some of those things in our conversation. And we'll start out. I wanted to find out, and I know this won't necessarily apply to Ayo, but for Chike and Yama and myself, what was your first encounter with the Sangha like? You know, we started to sort of talk about it, but that first moment when you entered the doors, what was that moment like? What was that moment like for you? What did you experience? I can start. I can tell my story, and I can say that for me, I came back in 2006. I came one day. I looked it up on Google. I found the Zen Center, and I came. And I just remember when I came, and I was like in awe of the space. It was just a beautiful, beautiful space. I was excited about being there and taking that step because it was a little scary for me in a new city, in a new space. But I also just felt the white gaze, right? When I walked in, there were people staring. I remember being there, and I didn't see any other Black people there on the day I was there. So I just remember the gaze, and I just, you know, the people staring and people no one talked to me. I remember just feeling so isolated, and I was already nervous coming in. And I just remember the disappointment in that and the fear that I felt in those moments of just being both highly visible and invisible at the same time, like under a microscope yet not seen. And I didn't come back for like a year. It was a long time before I came back again. And what I came back because I wanted and needed the Dharma. I needed what was being offered. But it was very tough. That's the impact it had on me. And, you know, I remember just, you know, going upstairs, and we'd have after the service, we'd go upstairs and have the cookies and the tea. And I remember just standing there, and I was invisible. And I just remember like just running out. And to this day, I do that. To this day, I have a difficulty standing in the space. And because even to this day, I stand there and I sometimes stand there. And I feel that I'm not seen. You know, so it's very painful for me to think about. I remember we did some panels for Beyond Fear of Differences And I was moderating those panels at the monastery and at the temple. We had two. And I remember people coming up to me at the and saying, "My name is so-and-so. I've never seen you before." And I said, "Oh, I have. I've seen you for 10 years. Seen you for 10 years. I know you." And it was just hard in that moment to realize, wow, you never saw me until today. And I didn't know what to do with that. And it hurt. To just say, wow, I've been here in this sangha this long, and this is the first time you've seen me. So that's my story. Even now I want to cry thinking about it.
I feel so sad hearing that, Tanya. I'm sorry. And if I was there and I didn't walk right up to you, I remember you from the temple, but I hope you weren't coming for years and I didn't speak to you. I know that I have had a really qualitatively different experience between, especially in my early years, between the temple and the monastery. The temple experience for me was much more like kind of going to commuter college, if you will. You know, everybody kind of comes in with the backpacks and your stuff, and you come in. And I was doing a lot of service positions, you know, back in 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000, you know, like in the early whatevers. And I had so much anxiety about learning my service positions that I was a little bit caught up in the me. And I see Yukon nodding because I was, I trained as a liturgist. I was so anxious, and Yukon and Jimon were my initial teachers, Yukon first. And I sounded like Minnie Mouse for like 3 months before I could like figure out how to get out of my own way. It was like, and I chant just fine, you know, but the, you know, getting out of my, you know, the service position thing, those of us who are practitioners, you know, you confront the thing and you got to get yourself out of the way, you know? But there was some, I think there was some solidarity, I think, that I felt in like, yeah, we're all coming in from our busy lives in the city. And like, here's a cloister that we're making together. And Shugen and Jimon were living there in those days. And so someone was always there. And so that felt okay. When I went to the monastery, it was a really different thing for me. I would show up for session, and there would be one Black man there. Nobody else, just one Black man, one senior student is a Black man. Who was there, and I look around, I just like saw nobody else, you know? And then I remember the first Shobo Genzo intensive. I remember it was held in the dining, what was the dining hall at the monastery, and Daido, we put couches in the fireplace, and Daido would sit there, and Shugen would sit, you know, teachers were sitting next to him, and we had this wonderful engaged the true Dharma eye, looking at the words of the text, and Daido, you know, we got into somehow a conversation about like who's not in the room, like that the Dharma was for everyone, and yet there were not, like, why do we not see that many like people who come like from the projects and stuff, like coming in to the monastery, you know, there's people from the projects don't come here. And I was like, I'm here. Like, I'm from the projects. I'm here. Right. And Daido said, "You don't count." And just went on like with the rest of the thing, you know, and there were little messages like that, that made me understand that I needed to, I then understand, I've grown in my understanding. Okay. I need to bifurcate myself. Not only am I biracial in the sense that I don't feel in ways that I fully fit in society anyway, I'm not white enough. Maybe sometimes I'm not Black enough, although the Black community is welcoming and accepting because we are different, right? But now in the Dharma, now I show up to be a practitioner, and there are all these aspects of my life that I'm supposed to leave at the door because it's too much anger and it's too much hostility. You know, I should share in the context of this because it's relevant that I'm a social justice lawyer. And when I started practicing at the monastery, I worked at the Legal Aid Society. And one of the reasons I came in was to try and deal with the stress of, like, it was tiring work. I loved my job. I didn't want to do anything else, but it was really tiring work. And I wanted to try and find some balance. And it was something that I didn't, except for Dokusan, I really felt no space to be able to talk to anybody in the Sangha about. And that's just sad. This bifurcation that I needed to make of myself in order to feel like I could come enough to practice, but I need to check, like, my activist self and my wanting to change, use the law as a tool for social change, and my very rich history, which I didn't even remember the early years of my Southern Baptist until Tanya asked me to do this panel, and I sat down and started thinking about my background. Like, I literally have cut off aspects of myself to be able to show up here in the Dharma. And I think we have to be able to bring it all in, right? Or what are we doing? So I'm sorry, I could talk, I guess, when I start.
No, that's amazing. We're going to get a little bit more into what you're talking about when we talk about how we arrived at MLK. Acknowledgement here at the temple. Thank you, TK. And Yama, tell us, what was your experience? Tell us about your experience in your first encounters with the temple.
With the temple, yeah. So let's start from when I first found the temple online. I was in New York, but then I left and went to Nashville, Tennessee. And that's where I gave birth. And I came back and went back for vacation. And when I was there, I was just confused and just hungry for something other than what I had. So a friend of mine, Bethany, who is into the Dharma and also hosts retreats, we started researching online about monasteries. But before that, I came across a monastic called Dandapani, who's from India, but spent majority of his time in London. He was in the business world, he was in the material world, and many of the things that he was doing then were things that I looked up to. But following his work and listening to him and just hearing him talk about the importance of solitude and being in a temple, living in a temple, in a monastery, how that can drastically change your life, it cut me. Because at that point, not only I was confused about what was happening around me, what was going on, and coming from a Muslim background, born and raised as a Muslim, I couldn't find refuge in that religion. And so me and Bethany, we started looking up monasteries, and she asked me, are you sure this is a step you want to take? And I said, I have no idea, but I'll give it a try. And then we saw Zen Mountain Monastery, and we started thinking of a plan of how I can go to the monastery without my daughter. But then eventually I came back to New York and realized there is a temple in Brooklyn, which wasn't far from where I was. But at that time, I was losing my apartment, which meant there was no place to go. But I had two options. It was either find a job and go work and pay the bills, or take the step and go to the temple and see what happens there. So for me, it was important. It was an important step for me to take to go to the temple. And so I went. Well, before I went, I called and spoke to Hogan. And I said I was ready to come and leave at the temple. And he said, wait a minute. Come in first. Take the introduction. you know, and see if this is something that you want to do, and then think about it. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, he doesn't know how ready I am to do this, but I'll go anyway. So I went for Sunday. And after that, he sat down and spoke with me. But it was funny because he thought I was coming to apply to be the office manager, which was something I didn't know that was possible in a temple. And I said, no, I just want to be a resident. And he said, ah, okay. But I think I went to the temple with a veil. I couldn't see anything because I was just ready to be there. I was hungry for it. Nothing was going to stop me. You know, that invisibility you talk about, Tanya, I didn't feel it the first time that I met Hogan, because he was the first person that I met. He was the first person I spoke to. I also told him my financial condition, that at that point, paying to stay at the temple could be an issue. He did work with me on that. But I couldn't see, right? So the very first time I felt that invisibility was at the hall, right? It's the hall where we have tea and coffee. And that was something I loved doing, preparing the tea and the coffee and the cookies. Oh, I loved doing that. But okay, Mama Tuti. But after the session, and this always after the session, I would stand by the door that was leading upstairs, going to the office, because my room was the office room. And I would stand just like that. And people would walk right past me. Just right past. Now, I didn't understand what that was, because for me, I was there for a reason. And that was the only reason that I was there. And I would stand there, the people like Hokyu. Hokyu would occasionally come and stand and talk to me. But there was a day that I said, oh, wow. Maybe they don't know what to do with me, because I couldn't understand what it was. And there were times that I was security downstairs by the door. And people would walk past, and sometimes I would say, bye, have a nice day. Some will say the same thing. Some will smile and look down. And some will say absolutely nothing. They just open the door and walk past. And there are some that if I don't say hi, they would just walk right past me. And again, for me, it was like, wow, okay, maybe this is the Dharma. But this is not a part that I want to pick. Because coming from Africa, you don't get to see the visibility of these issues, because mostly we're in a community where it's majority Black Africans. And even if you have white people come in, they come in voluntarily to be a part of those communities, to learn about the culture or whatever it is. And so they come with a different demeanor to Africa, the people that we're surrounding. And so all these issues were so new to me coming to America. And even being here for 10 years, I feel like I would never understand the issues of racism and how it unfolds in our everyday lives.
Now, Yama, how was the, when you said you became inquired about being a resident, mm-hmm. How was that described to you? That coming, you know, inquiring about being a resident, who did you speak to about that, and how was that approached with you? Like, what happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, all through my time at the temple, one person that I would always talk to, and whenever he had the time, he would give me 10, 20 minutes of his time, was obviously Hogan. So I enjoyed talking to him, and he was the first person I spoke to because he did the interview upstairs. And I always like to say that he prepared me in a way to understand what I was getting myself into, right? And what he said was, we had a full conversation about the whole wanting to be there, why I wanted to be there, why do I think that I could be, I can do that. And he said, you will be meditating for a lot of hours, but you will see that nothing's going to happen. And I said, oh. But then he said, I would have to let you know something, which is, this is predominantly a white sangha. That didn't ring any bell for me. Again, I'm from Africa. So it takes a while for these things to sink in. So I didn't ring a bell that this is a white sangha, would you be okay? And in my head, I'm thinking, why not? But I say, sure, I would be.
I guess one of the things, and it's an interesting thing to point out, you know, that, you know, if you come here, that this is a predominantly white, you know, sangha. Mm-hmm. You said, well, for you, you know, it was, you appreciated hearing that, right?
Yeah.
You know, I one of the things that comes to my mind when I think about that story, and then we'll move into the next section, is basically, you know, and I think that's important for, you know, people should know what they're entering into. I think that's important, but I think I would flip it. You know, right. I would have flipped it, and I would have said, you know, because to me, the way, you know, if we say to Black people, well, you know, you're going to be the only one here, and you're going to be coming into, can you handle that, right? Is this is the space in which you're entering. That's, you know, and I think I would flip that instead of putting that responsibility and kind of onus on the Black person to say, how can, will you be able to adapt to this environment? I would flip it and say, this is where we are. We have a lot of work to do. And how can we make this environment be something where you will feel that this is your place?
I wish those were not questions the way I asked. I wish that, you know, we didn't have to say this is a Black space or this is a white space. It's just a space, because a space is a space. Right. For me, I mean, living in America, that's one thing I've learned, is that these questions pop up to say, and it makes you get self-conscious of yourself, because that moment you start to categorize and differentiate the colors of the people that are coming into the spaces. It becomes something else. And for me personally, generally, I would say even the idea of those corrections, I mean, if we say we're one, then why do we need to explain those corrections? Why do we even need to answer or get asked those corrections?
Well, I think one of the things that we will see is in our next, you know, segment here, we're going to talk about the start of how MLK, honoring MLK, came to be. And in an ideal world, I think, you know, we wouldn't need to delineate. But I think the story of MLK coming to the MRO is part of the reason why it's important to acknowledge that experience of being Black in this sangha. I can say that, you know, we first did our MLK event last year, right before the pandemic. It was in January, obviously, of last year. It came about because I had noticed, I said, we've never acknowledged MLK in the whole time I've been here, 15 years. Like, We haven't done anything. I've had to go to other places like Insight Meditation or other centers and to get some sort of a Buddhist center honoring of MLK. And so, you know, I wanted that to change. And I said, this is my spiritual home and I want to be able to do that here. And so we started to plan and we were able to make that happen. But when I was speaking to Ayo, and maybe she could speak to a little bit about that and bring her into the conversation, is that I just brought it up. Oh, yeah, this is the second time we're doing this. And I told her the story about, oh, you know, and we, you know, had never done this. And she said, well, you know, that's a conversation. I think that's an important thing to dive into. And I, at that point, I had never thought about that being something to discuss, like why it took, you know, that being something that we're just doing and how that all came about. I don't know if Ayo has any thoughts about recognizing that importance of that conversation. But, you know, I just felt it was extremely insightful. I never thought about bringing that into this space tonight until she mentioned that to me.
Yeah, only to say I know that every community is different. And the communities that I've been a part of lately, that's not an issue. There is already a Martin Luther King Jr. gathering. But also I can imagine that there are communities where you kind of stick to the script, right? As a liturgist, you've got your liturgy. Martin Luther King Jr. is not going to appear in a Soto Zen liturgy unless intentionally placed there. He's not considered a deity, an ancestor, a bodhisattva yet. But what if he was? As well as other freedom fighters. And maybe I know this is not just about Martin Luther King Jr. You know, what I'm hearing is it's really the conversation up to this point to me has been about Buddhist hospitality. Two words that we don't usually hear together. What in the world is Buddhist hospitality, right? And from an African-American perspective, I won't speak from an African perspective, but from an African-American perspective, since probably 90% of us have grown up in church, we have certain ideas about and experiences of what hospitality means from African-American Christian perspectives. So, and it is just the opposite of what we experience when we enter as a Buddhist community first time, just the opposite, right? So therefore it must be wrong because this is not how people interact with each other naturally. So why don't y'all see me? Why aren't you talking to me? Why aren't you talking to each other? You know, just to have a little bit of intercultural competency and to take on intercultural competency, at least striving for it as a Buddhist hospitality would go a long way, I think, towards helping strangers, for whatever reason they are strangers, be comfortable that first time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if I could jump in here too. I love that. Thank you, Ayo. Buddhist hospitality. And I think one of the things that I've experienced as challenging in that regard is really just kind of, it's like, what is that little like joke? If you ask a fish, you know, how's the water? And they say, what's water? You know, because they're fish. That's what they swim in, right? We swim in whiteness. We really just do. It's the water, right? And I think we all at this point get that race is a construct. White race is a construct. Black race is a construct, right? But racism is real. And if we're going to talk about what it means to create a welcoming community for everyone, then I guess I'm with Ayo on, like, we have to understand based on whatever package we come in, right? Whatever Dido would say, whatever skin bag you know, we happen to be inhabiting, you know, because by virtue of whatever, right, that places on us different kinds of burdens. Together is how we have to co-create community, right? So I suppose if I come in as an African-American woman who has a certain kind of background, maybe it's on me to find enough courage and bravery to speak up and share my story and let folks know what's uncomfortable. But it's also on people who have a different kind of background to be proactive and say, how can I make you welcome? That's what I really appreciate about Tanya's comment in response to Yana's experience. Like, you know, maybe the paradigm is, how can we make you welcome? As opposed to, oh my goodness, I've got to find all this courage to figure out how to be so vulnerable that I've just shared with 90 something people, like about my black dad, North Carolina, and all this kind of stuff, because I want people to understand, because I love this sangha, because I love this dharma, and because some of you have seen me and you've made whatever kinds of assumptions you've made about who I am and what I think, or you're impressed maybe by a credential or not. But I'm just like a woman. I was just a little brown girl in the projects. It ain't no different from everybody else. And like, can we see differently together? Can we do that? Can we be uncomfortable together and co-create this space? So like, addressing your question, Tanya, about no MLK celebrations within the Sangha, I just took it for granted as part of a culture, a Buddhist culture that was starting to get used to and getting used to the forms. And this is something I've always celebrated every single year. And I found spaces outside of our Sangha to celebrate that.
So let me ask you then, because you and I've been here less than you, right, for a shorter period of time than you have. So you've dealt with this absence of MLK and other things in this space. Why do you think that this, there's been that absence? Why do you think that this has gone on for so long? Why do you feel that me, myself included, because I didn't say anything for 15 years, why do you think that we didn't say?
I think because, you know, right, I mean, I may change my mind tomorrow, but, you know, right now my answer feels like because of a misconception of what the Dharma is, maybe. You know, like we have this like idea about Dharma, let's put it on a platform, it's rarefied. Don't touch it, polish it, keep it special, but don't like interact with it. Like, don't think that it's part of you. Don't think the nitty gritty, like when you're sweating or when you, even though the teachings don't say that, I know from my practice, like there are teachings around how to wash your hands and how to go to the bathroom and how to do all this actual stuff, right? But I think some of us come in and we just think it's special thing. We go do the special thing there and we're going to be really devout about doing the special thing. And then we go back to life as if none of that has anything to do with it. And I
and
think
social justice has no place in that.
Social justice has no place in that. Keep that angry shit at the door. We don't want to hear that here, you know? And I'm sorry, but I think it's all of it. And actually, I know that we believe it's all of us. Enough of us believe it, all of us, because I wouldn't still be here if I had to literally tear myself in two. I found enough family here. There are people here who I consider my extended family, and I can have real conversations with some people. But when we're in the bigger spaces together and there are more people together, it's more and more uncomfortable. And that invisibility, people are afraid to look at you in the eye. They don't know where to look at you. I'm just going to stare at your toes, even when we're not in session, you know, because they're all so uncomfortable. That's why the brave, and that's why the together, that's why the co-create. We are all awkward. We are all awkward. Let's just embrace the awkwardness, man. Say, hi, I feel so awkward. I don't know you, you're not, I mean, but can we just, how's the coffee? You know, and like something will happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think what you brought up is an important point about we have this sort of perception of what the Dharma is and what it's not and what should be included in that and what should not. And I know I've heard that the political, that's not the Dharma. Like those things, that's not, those are, you know, that should not be a part of this, you know, and why are we talking about this? Because that's not what this is. There's, you know, and they, it's sort of this belief that we're creating the dualities, right? It's like, oh, you know, we can't, we're not really practicing, you know, the Dharma if we're talking about other, you know, your other experience, or we're talking about different segments of our society and putting them in categories of being disenfranchised or oppressed. You know, there is this idea that somehow it's just not welcomed. And maybe, did you feel, GK, or maybe Yama can speak to that, and I could speak to the experiences of maybe feeling like we didn't have, we couldn't, we didn't feel like that we had permission to bring these things into the space, to ask for that, to say we need that. Sure.
Right. Well, because no permission was granted. But I think I wonder about...
What do you mean by that, when no permission was granted? Explain.
Well, I mean, no permission is granted. It's just like, okay, I'll liken it to being gay in a heterosexual world. No, you don't. Until recently, right? You didn't see same-sex couples expressing affection with each other in public. You didn't hear people talking about it openly. So because of that, the absence of these things, you know, right? There's no permission to hold hands with your same-sex partner and kiss them in public, right? So, I mean, you just know, right? Because we're paying attention. But I think there might be something about spending enough time in the practice and the community and growing in it and maturing in it to a place where we feel confident about what the practice is about, where we can then say from an authoritative lived experience place, hey, what about this? You know, with authority.
And that growth is happening in our community. I think baby steps have begun. And I also think for me, you know, my personal experience, I guess, is because I have been practicing for a while and I know this path is my life. If I'm not going to figure out how to find the courage to show up here, where then, when, if not now, you know? And so there's a measure of desperation that's attached to my bravery, which feels like pleading to the Sangha, like, please, white people, take this up. Because
at permission.
Because I'm a people pleaser and I'm conflict averse and I have all this crap that I have to work on in my own existence, you know? But like, if we can't do this here in our Sangha, you know, with the Dharma, which is really guiding us as to like how to understand our interconnection, you know, and the Dharma is a rare and beautiful flower, and it's also shit, you know, like we have to figure out like our way and maneuver through it so that we can like co-create a reality that's better than the one, certainly the better than the one that's launched 2021. I mean, it's madness, right? That we're living through right now. Today, the Attorney General of the state of New York, Tish James, sued the city of New York and NYPD for how the city police department was brutal to Black Lives Matter protesters in the spring. Wow. A Black attorney general suing the city of New York for treatment of Black folks. That's progress. Right? That's some progress.
TK, can I ask you a clarifying question? I heard you say something about taking this up. What is the this that you want to be taken up?
Real identification, real understanding that we are the same. And just because we get like, I mean, could we get it any clearer, MRO family? Like Dida literally referred to it as a skin bag. That was one of the reasons I could continue to sit on that cushion. Because my understanding of that was it's just this bag of skin. It doesn't have any substance. that has any meaning to it. And then we have all our cultural biases that, like, we bring to it. That's what Beyond Fear of Differences is, right? Like, Beyond Fear of Differences is like, of course there's differences. Who would want everybody to be identical? What a boring world that would be, right? But we have our fears, and we got to own them. Let's move beyond them together to understand the truth of impermanence, to understand identification, and really bring those, I don't know, like, the relative and the absolute together. Stop rarefying the capital D, Hosanna in the highest, you know, as if that's the only thing the Dharma is. It is that, but it's also just like demonstrating, you know, when I wear my green legal observer hat so the police don't mistreat demonstrators, showing up. That's what I'm trying to say. I hope I've answered your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. The reason why I asked the question is because I think the more we, any of us clarify our requests, the greater the chance that that request will be met.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah. Tanya, yeah, yes. there's something that Chike said that was a light bulb moment where she said that there are times where the Dharma, it seems, we think it's polished and set up there. Nobody has to touch it. You know, there's that rigidity that is surrounding it, at least for me and my encounter to it, is I would say, normative standardized behavior that goes with it, where it is a specific and certain way that you need to behave and talk. And that part was also difficult for me to process, that there's this way that it is supposed to be. And what changed my mind in that aspect was the first day that I met Joanne, and she just walked into the temple and was all laugh and loud and talking. I never told her this, but I was watching her saying, I can act like that? Like, you can be this in a setting like that? Because before her, I did not see anyone who was that free. And I'm as you can see, I talk with my hands. I like couldn't do that. And so, yeah, that is important, that rigidity that it comes with.
And I think the rigidity is something that we need to deal with, reconcile, because rigidity doesn't leave much space for us and for our unique ways of being and presenting. Right. And that's something that needs to be, I think, for us to sort of talk about and analyze and think about and reflect on. Like, are some of these things, the ways that we do things, can some of those things, can there be more flexibility in that, that will allow people to be themselves in that, you know, while still practicing the Dharma, you know, in a respectful manner, but in a way that will help allow us to bring our full selves, you know? So, you know, I think that's something for us to think about. Now, I want to ask you, Ayo, I know we a little bit about the book Black and Buddhist, because I, you know, we talked earlier about this experience, and I know I've mentioned it about sometimes this idea of sometimes we can be in spaces for many years and not be seen. And there's a need to acknowledge, you know, our experiences of not being seen. And you literally helped edit and help write a book on the experience of being Black and Buddhist in these Buddhist spaces. And tell us a little bit about how the idea for the book came about and why it was needed. Why was it important to have these stories from people about their experience of being Black and Buddhist?
Yeah. I'll say that the idea, my dog decided to start barking when you called my name for some reason. So anyway, the idea for the book came at a conference of African-American Buddhist leaders in 2018. So as far as I know, there have been three gatherings. One in 2000 at Spirit Rock. There were about 20, I think, people of color who were leaders. 2018, it was specifically African-American. There were about 30 to 35 people. And then in 2019, there were almost 90 of us. In 2018, after speaking on a panel, I was approached by one of the editors at Shambhala, Matt Zeppelin, who asked me if I wanted to write a book. And so in conversation with him, I said, you know, the things that you think you want me to write about, there are many other people who can write about that topic as well. And the topic had to do with collective freedom, journeying together for a collective liberation. And so I said, well, if a book is written about that, it should be written by a collective. So then the question was, well, you know, the issue was, well, we don't like to publish anthologies. They're difficult to publish. And, you know, there's not one personality that the book is about. I said, yeah, that's right. That's the whole point. We want a collective effort. So they agreed. And I think they agreed because, oh, here's the reason why. I said, well, you know, there are books written by African-American people about Buddhism. You've got, you know, Jan Willis, got Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, Charles Johnson, Galen Ferguson, Jules Harris. You know, there are many, right? I said, but the problem, if it's problematic, the problem in white society when there's one Black person doing something is that they are considered the exception. Like GK was saying, oh, you know, I'm from the projects, or no, you're different. Different, right? I'm Black and Buddhist. Oh, no, you're different, right? And we know that there is a groundswell of African-American people embracing Buddhism. I don't know about Africans. Maybe Yama can tell us about that. But African-Americans embracing Buddhism, it's swelling, swelling, swelling. And so we thought it would be appropriate to have a book that represents the collective. And it's across traditions as well.
That's very powerful. We're very grateful to hear those different experiences. Like I said, we are not a monolith. We come from very varying backgrounds, experiences. And so I think it's important to hear all those voices, because I think you're right. I think part of the thing that happens to us, not just in the temple, but not just in our temple, in our sangha, but also in the outside world, is that we sort of look at one Black person and say, that's what Black is, or that's how Black people, you know, should be, you know, or that's what's the good Black person or the bad Black person. So there's a tendency to sort of characterize us and have an idealized Black person, right? And this sort of brings that to bear, that we have so many different experiences, so many different ways of seeing this. I want to also ask you, Ayo, if you could name two things that are unique to the experience of being Black and Buddhist, what would that be? What's different about that experience that may not be present for, say, other people of non-Black people of color or white people?
Well, here's the shortest answer is that to be Black and Buddhist is unique. Just that combination, right? It's still so relatively new. It's unique. However, what we see over these last several months and the months coming are books written by African-American Buddhist folks. I mean, more than ever before. Maybe 6 or 7 books will be coming out in the next several months and have come out in the last several months. But what intrigues me about the mashup, I'll call it a mashup, is what we do with it. What do African-American folks do with their Buddhism that other people are not doing with their Buddhism, right? So we have different existential concerns, more than one. We have different existential concerns. We have the concern of being wrongly accused of committing a crime or falsely accused of committing a crime, getting caught up in the criminal justice system, becoming imprisoned, and then being a slave by another name. This is what we live with. And we have the existential concern of being shot down by a police officer in cold blood, in daylight, recorded, and no justice for the survivors. And even in this very twisted situation we're in now, when I think about Kenneth Walker, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, for him to be blamed for Breonna's death is a very twisted way of understanding the dynamic between a Black man and the police when he's trying to protect his environment and they have a no-knock warrant. These are just some of the existential threats that we deal with. So we are skin, right? We are skin bags, but we're also storied people, right? And we also have our lived experiences. And I think the word, Chike, you used was epistemologies. You're an epistemologies person. I'm a hermeneutics person. How do we interpret this situation, objects? How do we interpret everything, right? So now here we are in this Black skin bag with our stories and lived experience, receiving the Dharma as written either in Japan or China or India or Sri Lanka or wherever. And I think what we want to know, even if it's not at the front of our minds, even if we're not conscious about it, how is this going to help me live with more ease, given the existential threats that I face as a Black-bodied person? So that's what the mashup. That's where it is. That's where the rub is. And if it doesn't help, I'll go somewhere else. You know, that was cool. That was cool. That was interesting. But nah. But the thing is, a lot of people are saying yes. It helps us be less angry, right? Not the absence of anger, but acting out of rage. And on that note, constantly, right? Being enraged. We need to know how to live without being enraged all the time. I would like to recommend what I think is an extraordinary book, Love and Rage.
Yeah.
By Lamarad Owens. Love that book. Everybody, please read this book. It's so wonderful. That's the answer to the question. It's the rub. And let me also say this. One of the things that really intrigued me that led me to do research on African-American Buddhists who also happen to be lesbians and also happen to be in the insight tradition was how does this stuff land on you? We have so many levels of oppression that we and discrimination that we live with and deal with daily. How does Buddhism land on you? Like, and what I found that was really critical there is that, you know, from a Theravada insight tradition, the teachings on no self are interpreted as interdependent, not as we're just an illusion, right? It's interdependence. But that interdependence that is embraced in Buddhism is in African traditions that's been passed down throughout. Oh, yeah, am I right? Okay. Passed down through the generations, Even if we don't use the word interdependence, we know that our survival in this country is based on our being able to depend on one another. Even those who are engaged in killing Black people, killing other Black people, when calmed down and not in the midst of survival, like that, we know that our survival is dependent on each other. And so we can't embrace some Buddhist teachings like you don't exist. That's not going to work for us. And to have a white person say that to a black person in a Dharma community, well, you know, you really don't exist anyway. Just think about that.
Mm. Wow. I want to hear from Chike and Yama if you have any thoughts yourselves in terms of what makes this experience unique, being black and Buddhist, apart from other experiences. Any thoughts on yourselves in terms of what makes that unique? Thank you, Ayo. That was just so powerful. I just wanted to say I was taking notes. That's everything you were saying, because it needs to be like analyzed after this. But yes, go ahead, Yama.
Yeah, there's something Ayo said that it makes us less angry. That is very important. I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had just given birth, and I needed my driver's license. So I went to get the driver's license. I could already drive. I mean, I had all the documents that I needed. And I went there, and they said I needed some document that I can't remember. So I said, why would I need that? I don't see a reason why I need that document. Because I brought a file of documents. I said, this is all I have. And I don't believe I need that document, because the people that are surrounding me saw my documents. They all have their driver's license, and they understood that as soon as I go, I could get it. But the lady behind the counter said no. Said, okay, confused, they went back home. And my daughter's godmom, she is a white lady from Kentucky who now lives in Nolensville, Tennessee, where is a community that you barely see any black person. She said, let's give it another try and go back. We went back. I got my driver's license the same day. And you know what she said? She helped my daughter, went face to face with the lady, used her southern accent, and said, she's working and she has a child. I need her to have her driver's license. I got it. So that point of the practice, now I don't identify as Buddhist, like I told you, Tanya. Identifying with any of the religions is something that I'm getting away from slowly. The practice in itself is, like I said, I told you that before, it was always at the back of my mind before I even came to America. Where to find it, how to practice it, and how to learn was my issue that I didn't know. Until that conversation with my friend. But the unique part for me is just being able to take that moment before I just slip and just be calm again and know that I might be experiencing this because of my color, but it is not going to stop me from going forward with what I want to do. That is my unique thing with the practice, that Ayo, you said about Africans and Buddhism. I'm not sure, because it's not a known, the community I came from is not a known thing to be a part of or even to talk about, because we have predominantly Muslims and Christians. But when it comes to the teachings in itself, it is rooted in African consciousness, right? That community, that people dependent on each other, that we can't do this alone. It has to be a community of people. which is why for me, I feel being in a community practicing makes it more powerful, because I'm around people, like-minded people, that are seeing things or are looking for the things that I want to embody in my life.
So again, so close, so close. We're so close to these teachings, and yet so far.
Ask a question real quick. Yes. Do you know the concept into as in Ubuntu, into? Yeah, into.
From what tradition, tribe?
Out of Rwanda.
Oh.
I think it comes out of Rwanda.
Rwanda.
But don't quote me on that one. But this is the concept that I'm talking about, that this interconnected ness coming out of an African consciousness that Black Buddhist practitioners in the Insight tradition are connecting to from an ancestral place, not from a Dharma place. It's just that the Dharma resonates with that ancestral.
And Chike, did you have any thoughts on what makes this experience unique for Black people specifically?
First I just want to acknowledge that painful experience that Ayana, had to deal with in order to get something she should have gotten the first time around, and that in a sense the practice does give us the ability, when we face circumstances like this, and to find the ability to respond and not react, right? There's enough space to breathe and center and respond and not react. But it's painful to hear that you had to have that experience, and those experiences happen all the time. As I've said to people who I know more closely in the Sangha, I sometimes will travel through the world. I do not travel through the world. I don't wake up in the morning and go, oh, I'm a Black woman. I'm just a woman. I just wake up in the morning. It's actually white folks who remind me by experiences like that. Right. Again, and that's part of the construct thing. I wanted to mention the anger, because I've worked with anger a lot over the years in the Dharma. And I had 3 years in particular, poor Shugan, who I just really was fury. I just, all my anger about injustice and society related to my work. And, I worked with him for years on that until I was able to sort of move to a different place. And I'll just share, I'm entitled to my anger. I have really good reasons for being angry. But what I do recognize now is that there's something more important behind it. My anger comes from a place of not connecting as deeply as I want to love, to connection, because I understand how we are the same, even though we're in different bodies, that this human animal has whatever capacities it has. And if we could get past the superficial, how much joy we would be able to live together. And so my anger is always because when I recognize the absence of those moments that have so much potential for shared joy, shared pain, whatever it is, shared authentic experience, when we put all the crap in the way. And I do think that being Black in a society just makes it such that, because I'm not permitted to forget in any day, I have to do a lot more practice to find generosity. I want to remind myself, this is an act of generosity right here, that I'm sharing my feelings and my pain and my desires about what I hope we could be. I think it's an act of generosity to be so public to share this with all of you. But you're my Sangha. And Sangha is about community. Sangha is together. We can't do it alone. I can't do it alone. I need you. I don't need you to fix me. I don't need you to diagnose me. I don't need you to solve my problems for me. I do not need you to feel sorry for me. I just want you to really be you and grow and stay tied to that innate curiosity that we have about what it is to combust this life together, you know? So I just think it's harder for African Americans because we keep, it's like a sidewalk that's been steam cleaned. Some people get to walk down, and there's a sidewalk that's had all these things thrown in front of it that some of us have to step over and negotiate to get to the same place. So I would say that's what I feel is the difference about being Black and Buddhist from my perspective.
And I agree, and I think that it's important for our white Sangha members and others to recognize that additional weight that Black people are bringing with them into the space, and how much more they have to work through as a result of that. And it needs to be compassion behind that, understanding behind that, and support, more support, I think, behind that, you know, to help them through that. I would say for myself, the unique experience is exactly one of the things that Chike said, is that I feel like I have to work harder at, you know, working through issues of anger and compassion. I struggle with compassion for that issue of how do I have compassion for people who have oppressed me or who engage in deliberate, egregious actions, you know, like that extra work that I have to do. But I also feel like what's unique is that I cannot leave a part of myself at the door. I just can't do that. You know, when we talk about feminism, one of my issues that I've had with feminism is that, you know, I'm supposed to bring the woman in there, but leave the Black out, you know, don't bring her in the door. Just bring the woman, but leave the black part out of there. You know, I can't leave parts of myself outside.
Can I say something?
Absolutely.
I know we're over time, aren't we?
Well, no, we're good. We're getting to the end. So we're good. Okay. I'm watching. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to say something that's not politically correct and could result in my NAACP card being taken away, but I'll take the risk, which is we don't know, just like you've been in this community and you're sharing your stories for the first time, we don't know anybody's stories. And there are multitudes of stories and traumas and experiences that are held in a variety of bodies. So when we say something like, I may have to work harder because I'm Black, you know, working on my anger because I'm Black or what have you, I hope that won't be taken as a negation of people's pain because you're not Black, right? So, because in these communities that we are in, if we're going to be brave together, right, then we have to talk, we have to be able to create space for everybody's pain and everybody's suffering, whatever the causes, right?
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to offer that because sometimes white guilt, white shame, white awkwardness, white indifference gets all mixed up in there, and then they say nothing, right? Well, you know, my pain is nothing compared to your pain. We don't have to compare our pains. But if we understand the causes, then we are acting and being congruent with what we say we are. As Buddhist identified, not Buddhist identified, contemplative identified, right, community-identified people.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that, because it's really true. I think we do end up in these oppression Olympics a lot. And we definitely don't want to engage in that. I want to move us into near our final segment, which is true Sangha possible? Now, we've talked about all of the challenges that we have faced as, you know, being Black and Buddhist. And so the question begins, is it possible for us to be in Sangha together, all of us? Black, white, all of us together. And you actually wrote a chapter in the book that deals with your own experiences of sort of trying to reconcile. Your chapter was called Voluntary Segregation, The Paradox, Promise, and Peril of People of Color Sanghas. And in your chapter, and you could talk more about this yourself, but you talk about your some of these really experiences of being not welcomed in predominantly white sanghas, and how you searched and searched and searched. You went many different places and you were finding yourself sort of outside. And then you were trying to find your way to something that would work for you, but you were having a problem with this whole idea of the separateness. Like, why do we need to be separate to practice? Why do we need to have a POC Sangha? So that makes sense. And we even have one here in MRO. We have a POC Sangha. We have a BIPOC Sangha, actually. So is it possible, if we have to do all of these different divisions, we have the what is whiteness group, we have the BIPOC group, is it possible?
That's a manifestation of community, right? Community doesn't mean that we all sit in the room together all the time, listening to the same things, doing all the same things, becoming, you know, the same thing. That's not healthy community. And I'm just saying that from a psychotherapeutic point of view. So to have a place where we can all come together and practice together, celebrate together, whatever, but then have places where we can have our special needs met, is a way of supporting culturally specific ways of healing. So what I have found is that when someone says, let's start a people of color sangha in you know, predominantly white space, almost invariably, it doesn't matter whether it's your temple or another person's temple or a small group, there is resistance to that. Largely, I think, because white people who are liberal, or, you know, they might identify as liberal progressive, have worked on being able to be with people of color, right? In their minds, I'm here, right? I'm here. I've evolved, right? And now you're the one who wants to take space. And what have I done? Right? I haven't done anything but be here, right? But there's only so much space when we get together to do what we do, right? There's only so much space. And so if you need space to say, you know what, white people get on my last nerves, that's probably not going to, you're probably not going to get enough space in a traditional sangha for that. But that doesn't mean that there's not true sangha, right? Of course, you know, us geeky people want to know, well, what do you mean by true? You know, let's break that down. What do you mean by sangha? Let's break that down. But I think it is just a natural inclination to feel resistance to people congregating around identity. And then within Buddhist communities in particular, oh, that's not Buddhist, right? We're trying to not be so clingy to identity, just to put it that way. But where does that come from, that resistance? That's privilege, right? Because you haven't been formed. Let me put it this way, and then I'll be quiet. We all haven't been formed the same way, right? Your skin bag has been treated different than my skin bag, right? Your skin bag comes with a different history than my skin bag, right? The things that I need to do to have a healthy ego may be different than what you need to do to have a healthy ego, right? until we actually are intimate with one another, until we've actually been brave with each other enough, we're still just representations to each other.
I agree. And I was going to mention, you wrote in that chapter, you said, by sitting together, POC, people of color, may experience a variety of forms of secular and spiritual liberation. To be liberated in any of these forms promotes the ability to be in solidarity with others. And I thought that was, you know, why we seek these spaces with ourselves. One of the things I just wanted to mention is that, you know, there is a lot of pushback. And I think that's something, you know, that, you know, I've experienced when these issues have come up. Well, you know, some of the white soccer members say, why do we need to be separate? Why? You know, that's not practicing, you know, Dharma and being separate, you know, and there was a lot of pushback. I remember one time when I was at Insight Meditation that there was a whole email chain that ran around where the question became where white people were objecting to the POC Sangha. That's just one day a week that they meet on Monday night, just one day. And there was a mass like hysteria around a lot of bitterness and hurt and pain because of the objections. When I was at Blue Cliff Monastery, we decided for the people of color retreat, we decided that the people of color were there because we were asked by the teachers, people didn't want white people in the space. They wanted to have it a really true people of color only. So that meant that, you know, not be seen. So the white people had to kind of go away and hide and sort of not be as inconspicuous as possible, right? And so, but there were people who were defiant, who said, no, I don't like this. I'm going to sit here in defiance, and I'm going to sit in this sangha, in this hall, and I'm going to sit here and I'm not moving. And there were people that did that. And so, you know, I think it's not even just a question of whether. I think we know we need, you know, as you said very eloquently, Io, that there is something to be gained from us having these spaces. But what do we do with that resistance, right?
Recognize it. I would just say recognize it. I understand you have resistance to it. And I hope that you work through that. And then go on about your business. Because here's the thing, I'm gonna say it as Resma Menakem said it to me. We are not going to undo 400 years of history in white body supremacy. So don't take on more than you should take on. I recognize your resistance. Thank you for letting me know. I feel that I need to do this, and I will do that. And let them work out their stuff.
And Chike, did you have any other thoughts? Oh, thank you, Ayo. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have any other thoughts, Chike, before we move on?
Yeah, I just wanted to express appreciation to Ayo for that framing, that like having the separate groups is community, it is Sangha. I think that's really important. I actually have not felt a whole lot of resistance to ideas to create new structures of support in the MRO, especially lately. But I want to identify, in the interest of staying vulnerable, that I find resistance in myself sometimes. You know, I think it's just very difficult for me to confront my own internalized racism. And then, you know, it's one of the reasons I find that POC spaces are really important for me, because I've internalized a lot of the patriarchy and the white power stuff in my own life and in my own body. And I have a lot of anger and self-hatred around the fact that I've done some of that. And it's painful. And I feel like in BIPOC community spaces, it's easier for me to deal with that. Because folks who have a different in bag have different things to wrestle with. And then I have so much gratitude in the ability to come together. And then the last thing I guess I would say is, I guess whenever I picked up this concept of mutual polishing, you know, that is what Sangha is and what Sangha does together, I feel like we literally need our spaces. We need women's spaces and LGBTQ+ spaces and trans spaces and Black spaces and South Asian spaces. Like, we need lots of spaces so that we can really deal with our own identity and what that means to live that in the context of Dharma. And then when we come together, wow, isn't that polishing better? Right? Like once we've actually had an opportunity to land our own skin and our own body and like really feel that. And I guess I want to shout out for a moment to Hojin Sensei, who's just taught me so much by the way she embodies Dharma and really brings like a physical embodied experience of like living and the Dharma together in a way that models for me that I maybe too have the potential to do that. But so I just wanted to identify like there's the macro and there's the micro, right? Just like racism exists on many levels, right? Institutional racism, interpersonal race, internalized, right? Like there are many structures within which we have to wrestle with all of these things. And I'm hopeful that we continue to co-create a space in our Sangha where we can work on all of it. And it's all still community.
Yeah. And I just wanted to also just point out to you, as you can see, we can talk about this all night, you know, all because this is a lot there. And, you know, we're containing this into this like really teeny tiny space. And so I think there is going to be a need to continue these conversations about the experiences of being Black and Buddhist and within MRO, within our particular Sangha here. I want to just acknowledge that we want to get to some questions, but I do have two final questions that I want to ask. And if people can stay on a little longer, just a few minutes, just so we can get a few questions in, if people, maybe two or three questions in. And if you can, I totally understand. But we've had a very rich conversation, and I wanted to, this is our moment to really have this conversation. And I just wanted to make sure that we were hearing these voices as thoroughly as possible. One of the things that you were talking about, Chike and Io, about the need for POC spaces, and that, and you, Chike, saying that they're making room for all of it. Do you think that there is a need for spaces for Black folks only? Do you think that that's a need? And if so, why? Maybe Yama, if you want to jump in, or Io want to jump in. But yeah, Chike, do you want to?
Yeah, this one's quick. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I kind of said why, which is like, I think there's a way in which we have to work on this in multiple ways and in multiple levels, systemic and interpersonal as well as internal. And those, I think it's important to create spaces where I don't know where I have always an issue with this concept of safe space. I don't know, safe. I think it's more brave. You know, I think it's more co-creating. I don't feel safe kind of anywhere anymore, but I'm also willing anyway. To try and be vulnerable. So, yeah.
Yeah. And Yama or Ayo? Yes.
I mean, it's like, what else would you say if not yes? And I do agree with Chike. I mean, going through the internalized racism that we have and just living and growing up in a world that is white and just white supremacists. You need that space. You need that space. For me, getting to the point where I am understanding that the values and the ideas that I was taught growing up is all rooted in white supremacists. It's painful, you know, just standing here and hearing my mom in my head saying, to Babi Alal and me. And if you translate that, that means God blessed white people. And getting to the point where I can break that down and see it and understand it, is you can only have that conversation in a Black Sangha, and they understand it and they can talk to you about it, make you understand. But at the same time, make you not destroy yourself with self-destructive thoughts. And in order for that to happen, you can only have that in the midst of people who are like you, who went through the experience and who understand it. Because anywhere else you say it, they might say, well, sure. So it's an absolute yes, because if we don't have it, then we destroy our very own communities as well.
Thank you for that. Thank you for your thoughts. Ayo, did you want to add something?
Yeah, only this. So, you know, I decided that I was going to be part of this conversation by imagining myself as white, as well as being myself. So here's something else as imagining myself being white. When I think about the anger and the rage and the destructiveness and the violence that has been culminating in a certain population of white people in the United States that resulted in many acts of violence over these last 5 years, many acts of violence, including the Michigan Capitol, you know, barging in there to U.S. Capitol. White aggression like that also needs its own group. The pain of that, the delusion of that, needs its own Zen group. And if someone wants to be really brave, put out there that you want to start a Zen group for white nationalists or something like that. Or, you know, transforming your aggression for white nationalists, whatever the right terms are. Because one of the things, and I'll say this, I feel like I'm talking a lot. One of the things that I really appreciate about the teachings and the writings of Thich Nhat Hanh is that I think he has been a master at understanding American aggression. From the point of vantage point of being a Vietnamese person, right? And so he came to the United States, came into the belly of the beast relative to Vietnam, came into the belly of the beast with an aspiration to end the war. And so he had to study, what is this aggression in this country? What is this aggression about? And what if we were to begin to think about what is this aggression about? This aggression that is so threatening, not only to people of color, but to white people too. White supremacy is bad for everyone. What is this aggression about? And what do I have to help transform this aggression in my own little way? Yeah, I think this is our Bodhisattva work right now. And so black groups, brown groups, red groups, yellow groups, white groups. The point is to be skillful in the transformation of this aggression, to be skillful in it.
And I will say, I have to admit, I'm going to be very honest. I still struggle with the idea that true song is possible in the way we are now. And I'm not just talking about just MRO specifically, but just in general. There's a lot of work to be done, in my opinion, before true Sangha is really, for me, it's going to be possible. And that, you know, it brings me to our last question, which is, what would it look like if you could show up as your authentic self? What would that look like? What does it look like now? What does it look like now? What could it look like in the future? And what will be needed to get there? And I say this because I feel that there's so many things that are not really spoken. And GK, you alluded to that earlier when you talked about how the uncomfortable feelings that we have, we don't express, we don't put out in the space. We don't acknowledge. Look, when Yama was standing there and people were just passing by, no one will say, I just don't know what to say to you. I don't know who you are, lady, and I don't know what to say to you. I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know who I can't even begin to relate to you because I feel uncomfortable. I don't know what to talk with you about, you know, and we don't voice those things, right? And I was talking about this earlier with the group when we were talking about how, you know, I also dash out sometimes because I feel invisible, but when the dining hall, when it's time to eat lunch, when there's time to eat dinner, how my mind goes back to like the trauma of high school. And I'm like standing there with my tray and I'm like looking around and there's a sea of white folks. And I'm like, who do I even sit with? You know, I just don't know who to sit with. And then people sometimes look at me, I'll sit down at the table, they'll sort of just look over and they'll continue their conversation. And I sort of feel like I'm in an episode of Mean Girls where they're like, you can't sit with us. You can't sit with us. And I feel like I'm just like, you know, feeling very insecure in those moments. And I don't, we don't speak that. Like, what does that feel like to like try to figure out where do I fit, even in a moment of just wanting to eat? Where do I fit?
The dining hall is the hardest place to practice at the moment. The dining hall is the hardest place to practice because it's clicky. There's like this group of people who are like, they just want to like that, have that time together. They just want to have, and I literally sometimes stand there figuring out, maybe I'll just sit by the fireplace, you know? I just want to put that out there. The clicky thing, I don't know. I dream of a time where the dining hall is also seen as an opportunity to practice, where strangers, residents go up to people and don't just run off. And I get the schedule is hard. I really do. So like, you know, no blame here, but I think also true is in those spaces we're creating, it's hard, it's awkward. If you're new, certainly if you're a person of color, you're always going to ask yourself the question, is it me? Did I not wear deodorant today? Like what? Like you're just going to go there because we're socialized in this country to go there. What did I do wrong? Is it because of my skin color? And in a space it's easier in the temple because cookies and schmoozing and there's fewer people. I would say also, wow, how amazing would it be to be able to feel like I could show up in any Sangha space as my authentic self, which could mean, you know, doing the didactic law professor thing, which I know how to do, but also going the, you know, but also doing the daughter of the Southerners. How y'all doing? Like, let's just, you know, keep it real. Let's keep it real, people. You know, like, can I be all those things? Because guess what? I am. And guess what? I know you are too, right? So I would like to meet you. I would like to know you, all of you, all of you. The weird you, the comfortable you, the uncomfortable you, the awkward you, the you who's running to grab a shower, you know, the vegan you. I just want to know all of you, because if we just pretend to be a little piece of ourselves, then what are we doing? I just don't get it. If we're not keeping it real, then why? That's what I want to see.
Yes. Yama, what are your thoughts on what would you like it to look like in terms of showing up Black? What is it, you know, what would you like it to look like in the future? And what do you think will be needed to get there?
That we can just show up. We don't have to show up Black. We could just show up. It doesn't have to be Black, right? I could just come in and just be there as a human being, just like everyone else. Because at the end of the day, right, the very science that we all, how do I say it, that we all respect and trust, that very science says that the beginnings of human beings started from where? Which means we're all what? African, right? And then initially, as humanity migrates, the colder you get to a place, to an environment, the lighter your skin gets. Which means that at the end of the day, it's still the same one human race. Why do I need to show up anywhere Black? Why can't I just show up and be there?
Yes.
And be like, hey, I have no idea what I'm doing here, but here I am.
Yes. And Ayo, we'll end with you with that. What how do you want to, how, what would that look like? What would it take to get there? Do you agree with Yama that you just want to show up? You would like
faith
to
in one, faith in oneself. Faith in oneself. You don't like it? Leave it. Right? And that's being one's most authentic self. You know, when we are in community, we do learn the norms, right? We don't become a part of the culture, and that's what happens, and that's how it is to be human. But if you feel after some time that you can't be authentic, that's not the place for you.
And I guess part of me, and I would even, I say, I worry that where will we go? You know, where are we going to go? You know, I don't know if we will find a place that we will ever be able to be fully authentic, that we would have to, you know, sort of push that to that point, you know, that we have to actively work to create that environment, right? That I don't know if that's something that we will ever find without effort on our part, right?
Yeah. You're looking for the pure land?
I'm looking for a place where the onus is not only on Black folks
okay.
to create those spaces.
After this conversation, with all the bravery and all the vulnerability and all the narrative sharing that has taken place just in these 2 hours, if there's not a shift in your community, then you need to really examine that. Because now, I don't know anything about your community, but what I do know is this. What we did here is what makes us real to one another.
So with that, thank you. I want to take do you know, Takeo, if we have any questions from anyone that wants to unmute and ask a question, or if you want to put it in the chat, you can as well. Yes, I see someone, Tom Kaplan.
Sure. Thank you. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Ayo, and anybody else who might speak to it, have you seen or heard about sanghas where the most difficult experiences of Black people and people of color, like feeling ignored or invisible, where that's growing or somewhat of the norm? And can you say anything about what they're doing in that community, whether it's the community as a whole or people of color or the white people, to help nurture that?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I'll say that. So Common Ground Meditation Center, which is in Minneapolis, and Clouds and Water Zen Center, which is in St. Paul, currently have come together to offer a 7-month study on Rezma Menakem's book, My Grandmother's Hands, which is about dealing with racialized trauma. So the teacher team is multicultural, but it's Minnesota, right? So most of the students, like 90% of the students, are white. However, for the people of color who want to opt into a people of color small group, because we also utilize small groups, they have the ability to do that. So we've got teachers who are people of color. Most of the students are white. Options for people of color. And that's just one model of how we're teaching that course. But also I'll say this about the Insight community largely. Spirit Rock recently graduated, I think, 40 Dharma teachers, 4-year study. I think half of them are people of color. IMS, Insight Meditation Society, is doing something very similar, and I think their last training is this week. And so leadership matters, right? White leaders who are arriving at cultural competency, they matter. People of color, leaders, they matter. And collaboration across traditions, bringing different folks together to study a work written by a Black man about racialized trauma. All of these things matter. And I think each community needs to figure out what the ingredients are, right? Instructions to the cook. What do you have to work with and bring that to bear? Did that answer your question, Tom? Yeah, okay, thanks.
Any other questions for our panelists? I can, while we're waiting to see, oh, yes, we have Tyson.
Don't let Ty speak.
Oh. Well, I am from Clouds and Water, Zen Center in St. Paul. So I have a question. So there was a person who in our Sangha at one time, and I met this person at a retreat, and this is a person that identifies as a person of color. Anyway, so then we got back together and I saw her at the Sangha and I went up and I'm like, hi, I'm really glad to see you. That's kind of how I am. You know, I'm just like, hi, how you doing? Anyway, so late, and then they were mad at me. And then they said, I think you're just being nice to me because I'm a person of color. So it's sort of like, it was kind of a, like, so first of all, I didn't think I was doing that. Maybe I was doing that. I just thought I was doing it because we had a nice connection at the retreat. But anyway, I just want to, like, what do I do about that?
Well, I mean, I'm going to offer something. I would say one of the first thing is to ask. While you were talking to him, why, you know, can you, you know, explain why that brought that up in you? Perhaps that person could have been, there could be other reasons, you know, maybe others have reacted in this kind of, because I can say this, I'm going to say this. There are many instances where people come to me in a very unnatural manner. And I'm not saying it's just within the MRO, it's outside of MRO and my life. And people come to me, it's like, and they treat me in this way. And you know, it's, they're just trying to be overly enthusiastic. It's like, they're really trying really hard to be, you know, and we can pick that up. Like, this is not normal coming from a place of, you know, just a natural interaction. Do you act like this with other people? You know, and so that could be what that person has brought into the space. And, you know, and sadly, maybe it was, you know, reflected to you. But what did you do? Did you have a conversation? Did you ask them, you know?
And I just, what they said was, just go, hey, you know, just come up to me. Don't make a big deal of it and just go, hey. So then what I did was when I see this person, I'd be like, hey, you know, and I try not to make a big deal about it. And then after that, then we were able to have a conversation. So anyway, so we worked it out, but it was just really like, and I will just own, I could have been, probably was a little nervous. You know, I tend to be a little anxious. So, you know, I probably was a little over the top, but I'm kind of over the top anyway. So thank you for that. That was very helpful.
But and just to jump in quickly on that, I think that, you know, what you found is the solution, just to ask. Hey, would you like some company? Hey, for a conversation, you know, asking goes a long way.
Thank you for that question, because I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. They have similar feelings that crop up, and I think it's important to just acknowledge it. I felt nervous. I didn't know what to say. And I think people would appreciate that honesty, you know, from people that I just don't know how to start this. And Kaijin, is it Kaijin? I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. If I'm not, let me know. You can unmute.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, first of all, Tanya, I want you to know that my family thinks I'm weird too about being a Buddhist. They are all very working class, and it's a complete waste of time. What the heck are you doing? Spending all your time doing that. I really appreciated you each sharing so much of your own selves and having the chance to get to know you. And the one question I had was, I was thinking about what you're talking about in terms of how you have that feeling of being invisible around white people. Okay. And I was thinking about how the Zen culture, especially Sesshin, is like, okay, you're supposed to be in silence and your eyes are down. And I was wondering if it might be helpful for people who are like coming to the monastery or whatever, all people, because I'm sure that I know that, for instance, my sister, who's an extrovert, she would freak out with the culture of like being in silence and nobody looking at her because she's an extrovert and she couldn't, that would not be comfortable. So I was wondering in terms of that Zen culture, if giving people a heads up on it, like this is what it is and this is what the intent around it is, like to create a container where you're kind of going inward. And I don't know. I was just wondering if like sometimes if the invisibility thing, if that, if the fear of being made invisible might get triggered by the Zen culture. And if there's a way that maybe the Zen culture could be, could just be respectful of that possibility. So.
Anybody want to take their hand?
I mean, I'll just say my experiences in about that are not about Sesshin. You know, Sesshin, you know, we're all, it's just Sesshin feels to me like a dance that we do together where we're intentionally dropping that stuff as the teachings tell us. So I have not personally experienced any like feeling of harm or disrespect or being ignored in the context of Zazen Kai or Sesshin. Because that's what I'm doing. That's what the precautions are. It's really the informal spaces, much more so. And I think that it's not really Zen culture so much that dominates the informal spaces. American culture.
Yes, and I want to piggyback on what Chike said because that was my reaction. You know, what initially came up for me when I heard your question was that, you know, we in this country, we create cultures around things. And even in Zen, like that's a Americanized, you know, very influenced by American ideals, you know, and particularly white American ideals. And so, you know, when we say, well, you know, people, helping people to understand that this is what this is, maybe we can ask the next question. Okay, but why is this this? Why is it this way? Can it be something else, right? And who determined what that this is? And how in that determining is that excluding? Is that not opening up space for others, right? That's just my reaction to that.
Thank you.
I want to acknowledge, in case anybody has any questions, we can take one more for time, but I just wanted to acknowledge what some people said in the chat. If anybody has one more question, they can feel free to raise their hand. Someone said, I didn't understand why MRO needed a women-only session until I attended one. So I thought that was very interesting. I have attended that one, and it was, believe me, it's needed. And someone said, to all panelists, thank you so much for sharing your stories, your feelings, your experiences of the Dharma and our Sangha, your concerns, ideas, so much to be revealed and to be done together. And someone said, right on, Ayo. Lots of right on to Ayo there. Someone said, I appreciate the loving generosity offered by this fabulous panel. Entering Zen and Buddhism meant othering to you, articulated by Tanya, that being othered in a religious setting might not be something that many people who identify as BIPOC find easy to take on, and what is often entered as a calming and comforting space. And then someone else said, thank you so much for sharing so thoughtfully, vulnerably, and bravely with us. What a gift you have given. Thank you. And people, someone mentioned that it was incredibly generous for us to offer ourselves tonight. Joshin, thank you. Wanted to express my deep gratitude for all of this heart sharing. Thank you to the panelists, to Tanya Big Abrazo, is that how you pronounce it, for pulling this together. And I can see there is one hand up, Dojaku?
Jaku.
Jaku, sorry about that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for this. This was wonderful. And I think the conversation about just like culture and American culture, I think is really important. I'm wondering just like, you know, I think the point about hospitality was a great one. any other thoughts about like how specifically like the White Sangha members can make the space more welcoming? You know, so, I mean, I know there's like, it's up to us to kind of like, you know, to work with that. But I'm just wondering again, like kind of off the top of your head, if there's anything other than like being friendly, but not like overly friendly, that, you know, that would help make the space more welcoming.
Can I start?
Absolutely.
I would say make some friends outside of Sangha, you know, make some friends. Like when we make friends with people who are different from us, we're not like, if I talk to anybody, I'm not gonna, if I have that intimacy with that person, right? If I'm meeting them and their shared humanity with me, I'm not really thinking about a special question to ask them or how to say something or do something. It's just a natural thing that happens. And I think that there needs to be more opportunity for white people in our country in general to get out of their silos and their segregated self-segregation and to develop more intimate relationships with Black people in general. So they recognize that the same things you talk about, that's what we talk about. The same silly shows you might watch on television, we watch those things. The same desires that you have, we have. You know, the same fears, we have. And then that makes that conversation just like a conversation. But that's just my, please jump in, anyone who wants to do so.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, you know, emotions and feelings have no color and it has no race. And so, you know, personally, I want, when you talk to me, if you're weird, I want all of that. I want to talk to your weirdness. That's what I want to see, who you are, not necessarily who you think I want you to be when you speak to me. Because that wouldn't help me. Like, talk to me like you talk to your friends. And get proximity as well. The temple is in downtown Brooklyn. There's quite a number of Black people around there. Do we just walk past them? Do we just walk past them? Even if they're drunk and falling in the streets, they have a story, and you never know when you speak to them how they might impact you, how much they might affect you. There's really no special way of making Black people feel comfortable. It just depends how comfortable you are in yourself to bring yourself out when you speak to human beings and not necessarily a Black person. Right, because born in Africa, but I grew up in a diverse place where my first cousins and so many family members are biracial. And so speaking to a white person isn't a new thing to me. But then coming to America and people looking at me like I'm from a place where I've never worn shoes before, and feeling like they have to bring all these ways of talking because it's Africa, you know, talking, bringing all the Zulu languages. I'm like, I'm not from there. I have no idea what that language is. So the question is, how comfortable are you in yourself to bring that out when you meet people and not Black people?
Ayo, do you have any thoughts?
Just be human.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have any special things we talk about. Trust me. Just,
right. I mean, we've been human since we've been human. This is not rocket science. Right?
We're nothing special.
Nothing's this. Hello. Welcome. Any questions? Be willing to answer those questions. I'm here if you need me. End of it. What was that like for you? Okay. All right. Any questions? hope you come back. If it was good, you know, if it was a good experience for you. Oh, it wasn't? Tell me more. Okay. How can we make it better? All right. We'll work on that. Hope you come back.
Yeah, I would like to see MRO and any Sangha make opportunities for us to be together outside of, you know, the services and the things to get to know each other. And because I think that's the key. I think once people, especially white folks, once they see that we're not any different, and once they understand, oh my goodness, they want the same things I do. And then it's just like, oh, and then all of a sudden that could change their whole perception. What is his name? Thaddeus Stevens, the one who the lore goes that the reason he was so into like progressive in terms of helping to advance the advancement of Black people from the oppression was because he had a relationship. He had relationships. We call it that. With a particular Black woman and others who can change your opinion, your thought processes about when you think somebody is so different from you. You know, I think white people in general think we do something special and we go home. Y'all about to know me right now, but we're not going home singing. Like, I'm not singing at home. Like, you know, I'm not doing anything different. I go home. I'm like, oh, I just need to relax. I take my shoes off. I just want to drink some tea. I just want to, you know, whatever. We like, this no different. Like, nothing, nothing. So, you know, I think that's just about us being separate. We go home to segregate. Even in New York City, we go home to segregated communities. We might work in the same place. Some of us come to work. But then we go home and we don't see, and then we're in our own segregated communities. And there is not that opportunity to see someone in their full humanity, to say, this person is the same as me. And let's just have a conversation. Let's just talk. You know, I don't have to do anything different. But we can see when it's not authentic. People pick up on that, and some of, you know, and it can become that tension that enters the space. I'm sorry, Chike, I didn't mean to. I saw you. Okay.
No, I only, believe it or not, I have a meeting.
Yes.
After this meeting that I have to go to at 9 o'clock. So I just wanted to express my appreciation and love for this Sangha. And I tried to find some bravery tonight. I want to really thank my co-panelists.
Absolutely. Sonia,
for brainstorming and Hoj and Taikyo for like pulling it all together and make it happen. Ayo, what a pleasure and an absolute pleasure to meet you and hear you. Yana, pleasure to meet you. And I'm going to have to sign off. But anyway, thank you. And I'm looking forward to the future. Let's see what we can combust.
Yes. And this is a conversation that will continue. And I know it's 9, we do need to end, but I just want to make sure we had some time for some questions, and thank you for those who asked them. And thank you for this is a continuation. Please join us on Sunday when we continue our MLK reflecting on MLK and his legacy. We have some special things planned. And I also, just want to encourage people, if they can, to join us for that. Thank you for staying a little bit later to allow us to take questions. It's not easy to do this, to hold these spaces, and there's a lot to say and a lot to share. So thank you all for being patient tonight. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful conversation. Thank you.